This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Growing up in turn-of-the-century Georgia, the Lumpkin children were steeped in a culture of white supremacy. The older girls performed in rallies for the lost cause, while their father took a direct role in the Ku Klux Klan. But the two youngest Lumpkin girls veered well off the path their family had set for them. Grace and Catherine Lumpkin both became activists and authors who railed against racial and economic oppression and fought for causes including desegregation. And though they traveled far from their roots, both geographically and philosophically, the sisters never renounced their Southern identities. The stories of these three youngest Lumpkin sisters are now chronicled in a triple biography crafted by master historian Jacqueline Dowd Hall. She's the author of Sisters and Rebels, A Struggle for the Soul of America. She's also the founding director of the Southern Oral History Program and a professor of history emerita at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jacqueline, welcome back. So good
Thank
to have you.
You
here.
Glad to be here.
What a remarkable story. Tell us about the Lumpkin family, first of all, and then we'll find out about these three girls.
Well, they were originally from Georgia, and the Lumpkins were governors and Supreme Court justices, a very wealthy slave-owning family. The particular Lumpkins that I write about were from more modest stock, but they were slave owners in Georgia.
Talk about the upbringing of the three sisters, Elizabeth, Grace, and Catherine.
They moved to South Carolina at the turn of the century, and their father made a career of promoting the lost cause, and he trained his children to do the same. So he took them to Confederate reunions, taught them to be orators, and put them out there on the circuit.
Elizabeth took this to heart. She was quite a performer.
She was. She was actually quite famous in those circles at the turn of the century, and she parlayed that into a career as a professor of oratory, briefly.
And it was not uncommon. I think this is something that's interesting about that period, right around the turn of the century here in the South, where women were taking a lead role in promoting this cause, Daughters of the Confederacy. Certainly the essay or the editorial that would eventually become the tinder that stoked the fire that we now know as the Wilmington coup d'etat, written by a woman about protecting their men, right? So women were very much involved and expected to be.
Absolutely.
So Elizabeth was playing her part. Her younger sisters took very different courses. Now talk about their trajectory, because early on it seems to me they must have sort of bought all of this.
Oh, they did. They were steeped in it. They believed in it completely. But little by little, things began to happen that opened their eyes to other ways of thinking about the world.
Well, let's take them on one at a time. Grace and Catherine are the two we're talking about. Let's talk about Grace for a moment.
Grace, who was the middle sister, Catherine's the baby, Grace stayed involved in lost cause activities for a fairly long time. Catherine, by the time she was coming along, it began to seem kind of sad rather than exciting. These very elderly men listening to these little girls praise their prowess on the battlefield. So she was never as completely caught up in it as the other two sisters.
But it's a hard thing to escape. I mean, you talk about Grace eventually becomes a novelist, lives in New York City. Catherine studies at Columbia and worked for desegregation along with black women and the YWCA. It's unimaginable how one escapes from this, even if you're a little bit bored at the whole thing. You can't imagine running away from this ultimate truth that you've had in drink and sleep, right?
Yeah. Well, one of the things Catherine says in her autobiography, something that I think really sums up how she saw what happened, what enabled her escape. She talks about how the South seemed to be this fixed, frozen entity, but some of us, as she says, though molded in a bygone day, saw in the South the so many contradictions and so much dynamism that started us down the road to change. So there are all these contradictions built into what seems like this very monolithic ideology that they're being conscripted into.
But the ability to see those contradictions and write about them so eloquently speaks to the ability to pursue intellectual, first of all, having some intellectual curiosity, and then somehow being able to pursue and nurture it, right?
That's right. And I think it started with their mother, who had a wonderful tutor when she was growing up, a legendary tutor, and who had taught briefly before she married. And her learning was a point of pride in the family. And she read to the children every night and imbued them with a literary sensibility and with a curiosity.
So once you start doing that and reading more widely, the likelihood that you're going to stick with the program is reduced somewhat. Let's talk at this moment about your research, because it is extensive, including interviews with Catherine and some of the others that interviewed many people around this question. Talk about the interview process when you first learned about these sisters, and maybe even before that, how you learned about them.
I discovered Catherine's autobiography in the 70s when I was still a graduate student trying to write a dissertation in the new then field of women's history. And I loved the book, but I was really puzzled by it. Elizabeth, who seemed like a fascinating figure, appears and then disappears. Grace is never mentioned. Catherine ends what's supposedly an autobiography when she's still in her 20s. So what happened to them? I was curious. And so when I came to Chapel Hill to start the oral history program, I took the chance to find them and found Grace. Elizabeth had died, but Grace and Catherine were living in Virginia by then in retirement, and I interviewed them in 1974.
Tell us more about their paths now. We haven't really followed them through, Grace, because Grace does come back to her roots. Catherine does not. So let's hear a little bit more about Grace and her career as a radical novelist.
Well, she goes to New York in the early 20s and immediately falls in with the Lower East Side crowd of communists and bohemians, and is just swept away by the excitement of it all. And in 1929, the famous Gastonia strike breaks out. And along with, she's not the only person who does this, but she decides to write a novel about the Gastonia strike, which she publishes in 1932 to quite great acclaim. So suddenly she's a radical literary star.
I mean, writing about not only because remember that strike occurs because of the communist philosophy that black and white workers should be brought together in the struggle against capitalism and the ownership process, right? So this strike happens with black and white workers working against the company. And she's, so not only is she fighting for desegregation, but also communism, and she's
exactly.
A daughter of the South.
Exactly.
And as you say, a successful novel. And so it ain't like she just, you know, having these thoughts all to herself.
Right.
So meanwhile, so we're going to put that on hold for a minute and talk more about Catherine's trajectory here.
So Catherine, both of them had been exposed to the YWCA in college and to the social gospel. And that was formative for both of them. And Catherine went to Columbia to graduate school, as you said, and was actually disappointed by what she found. She thought she was going to find this great liberal bastion, but she studied with these reactionary sociologists. But she found her way to the YWCA headquarters in New York. And from there, she ended up being hired to be the director of the YWCA in the South. So she returned to the South in the 20s, and with a group of young black women tried to build an interracial student movement in the South in the 1920s.
You spoke with Catherine, and we have an excerpt from that interview now, where she talks about what she thought was happening and why the YWCA was so influential at that time.
This was the time at which the so-called social creed of the churches was appearing. By pure chance, we had a visit from one of these ranging national secretaries of the YWCA, mm-hmm. who came in, saw us as a fruitful field, a hopefully fruitful field there. This was the great wide world that they were bringing in. Mm-hmm. They were far-thinking women. Mm-hmm. They were professionally minded women too in this period. You mm-hmm. see, they were able to draw to themselves some very remarkable women.
Catherine Dupre Lumpkin in an interview with my guest Jacqueline Dowd Hall. Jacqueline's new book is Sisters and Rebels: The Struggle for the Soul of America. Jacqueline's going to be reading from the book at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on June 6th, and of course we'll have that at our website, State of Things. org. And so again, the power of women and a developing women's movement now, because there had been, and she talks about this with you, the fact that women were involved in progressive movements in their own way, but now things were changing and women were able to take a more forward role in the movement.
That's right. And that these women she was involved with in the YWCA saw themselves as part of the women's movement that had come, that had just achieved suffrage not long before. And she and Grace both went on then in the 1930s to be part of a strand of the feminist movement that tried to link women's issues to class and race issues, which is not a strand of the women's movement that's very well known.
No, and certainly, again, would not have been well known in the South, or at least to a woman like Catherine, given her upbringing. But again, we think about the fact that her mother nurtured her intellectual curiosity through reading and through other reasons. So what struck you about your interview when you were talking with Catherine? What struck you in that conversation?
Oh, wow. Well, one thing that struck me is that she was very willing to talk about her early life and about her years with the YWCA eloquently and in detail, but she absolutely would not talk about any of the rest of her life. So, again, I came away with all kinds of questions and all kinds of silences.
What else would you wanted to have known?
Well, I would have wanted to know what kind of career she had, what it was like to be a woman trying to carve out a career in a male-dominated academy, what it was like to live for 30 years with a very interesting woman who was an economist, a radical economist, who she never mentions and doesn't talk about. What it was like to be involved in trying to support and expand the New Deal, which was her major focus in the 1930s. Many things.
Many things. Grace also, we talked about her living the bohemian life, talking about the great Gastonia strike and the role of the communists, but she then reverts and has another change of heart. Tell us more about Grace.
Yes. Well, beginning in the 1940s, her writing career is faltering. Her marriage breaks up. She's dirt poor. She's more and more isolated. And as by the late 40s, early 50s, the temper of the country is changing. So we have the McCarthy era, and people are becoming professional anti-communists.
Yeah, and snitches.
And snitches. And she's involved with one of the most famous anti-communist of the times, Whitaker Chambers, a very close friend of hers and her husband's. And she gradually changes with the times, basically.
Yeah, and tries to actually inform on her sister.
Yes, she does.
And for some of this research, you actually have FBI records, right?
Yes, yes.
So, Woody, I guess you've indicated that maybe it was the dissolution of her career and marriage and the ways in which her life was changing that may have caused this change. What about the relationship with both of them, or for both of them, with the South and their families after they had made their break?
They ended up being very painfully alienated from their families. That's another thing I would say about Grace when I talked about isolation. Particularly when Catherine published her autobiography in 1946, her brothers were appalled, and some of them wouldn't read the book, and they were also appalled by what they imagined to be Grace's lifestyle, which they didn't really understand, but they suspected the worst. So there was a long period where Grace and Catherine were not in close touch with their brothers. They did stay in touch with Elizabeth, although she disapproved also.
And what's interesting about them is these aren't just two fascinating characters who a historian might discover in her work. The fact is they had really, as we've pointed out a couple times, come to the attention of readers in the United States and the FBI. You talked about those FBI reports that you looked through. The FBI was looking very closely at their careers and their activities, right?
Oh, yes. And unfortunately, that turned out to be one of my main sources because they had destroyed so many of their papers, as did many people who had been involved in the radical movements of the 30s when the McCarthy era came along. People destroyed their papers. And so the FBI reports were the only way sometimes that I knew exactly where they were and what they were doing at any given time, because they were spying on their every move in reporting on the most mundane things in their lives.
It's kind of fascinating in a time when perhaps the rest of the country is not taking women terribly seriously. We're talking about the first third of the 20th century. The FBI and the people who are supporting this very, the patriarchy and this patriarchy and support structure of white supremacy are taking women very seriously.
Yes, yes, that's right.
What do you think is the impact ultimately of those sisters, and what does their story tell us about perhaps women in the South?
Oh, well, two things leap to mind first. One is that they tell us a lot about how to grapple with the question that we're still grappling with, which is how to face up to a legacy of slavery, segregation, white supremacy. That's what they did, and they did it coming out of a much more difficult place than most of us are coming out of. So that's one thing. The other thing is that they show us that the South is not just a monolithic, regressive place, that there's an indigenous progressive tradition, including a feminist tradition that's organic to the South. And these women and their friends and colleagues are examples of that.
Jacqueline Dowd Hall, author of Sisters and Rebels, A Struggle for the Soul of America, also founding director of the Southern Oral History Program and a professor emerita of history at UNC Chapel Hill. Going to be reading at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on June 6th. We've got the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Jacqueline, what a pleasure as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on The State of Things, what happened to the idealism of the 60s, if it ever was? Lewis Shiner joins us to share how that question inspired his latest novel. Stay with us.